welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and it is the 20th of May 2014 and this is episode 184 of the podcast. Now today I have an interview with Ryan Holiday, who is, he's pretty uber famous in a small niche of the internet, as in he's done the book marketing for Tim Ferriss for the four hour chef, I think, one of them anyway. He's also helped Tucker Max, who's quite famous for Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. And he also does marketing for big brands. But he's a very philosophical guy, and it's quite cool. His latest book is called The Obstacle is the Way, and it's based on Stoicism. So we talk about a load of things in the interview around some of his, I guess, philosophical things, which I think affect the author mindset. So asking about longevity and the body of work. And yeah, it's a really good interview. It kind of roams around, but I do get in some questions about marketing and podcasting, which is quite interesting. So that is coming up. Industry news, the latest author earnings report is out, which is the thing that Hugh Howey does with Anonymous Data Guy, which is at authorearnings.com. The May 2014 report is out. It's quite interesting if you're listening to this years in the future, to see, you know, how things have changed. But it's essentially that they've done this, I guess, as a quarterly report, having a look at the Amazon sales, and it shows that indies are taking market share very slowly. There is an extremely interesting graph showing author revenue and how the indie segment of author revenue has been growing steadily from around, well, really the beginning of 2013, it starts to be significant. And then, really it's a quite a big chunk in April 2014. It looks like it's more than the big five publishers. So that's really, really fascinating. I think it's definitely worth reading it so that you can understand. They've also done one on genres, and clearly the best-selling books in the top 100,000 are often genre books. So the report really only applies to some people, but it's worth looking at. You know, so you can be proud, be proud to be an indie. And I say that as well, because I've just come back from Crime Fest in Bristol in England, where we had an indie author panel, the very first one at a British crime festival. Harrogate is the next one, and they have announced that there will be one there as well. But ours was basically five indie authors. I did the, I actually picked people, and I did the chair, the moderation, and we had a really brilliant session. We had loads of people say it was one of the best at the festival. I think mainly that comes down to the fact that I hate the us and them separation that often exists at these events, so I made sure to very much involve the audience, and we had a lot of laughter and it was really good fun. So why I stress that is I think we should all be encouraging literary events to open up to indie authors, and there is a great book out at the moment, just come out from the Alliance of Independent Authors, called Opening Up to Indie Authors, and it's a guide for literary festivals, for book, so really for getting your books into literary festivals, bookstores, libraries, all the places that at the moment are more difficult for indie authors. We know how to sell ebooks, print on demand, and now audiobooks with ACX. But in terms of getting print into libraries, for example, there's a lot more that needs to go into it. So I highly recommend that book, Opening Up to Indie Authors, and that is from the Alliance of Independent Authors. Fantastic, useful book. on my news, yes, this week I am working on the launch of Pentecost in German. If you do speak German or you know anyone who is German and would like a review copy of Pentecost in German at any point in time, please do email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, and I would love to give you a German copy to have a read. We're getting really good reviews on, excuse my terrible accent, on vorablesen.de, which is a fantastic pre-reading site, a bit like NetGalley. And we're really hoping that those reviews will spill over onto the ebook stores when it's out. And we're working on the print version as well. So I'm really excited to be having my first foreign language book happening. So I will obviously report back on the German stuff once we know what we're doing. I'm meeting with my translator tomorrow and we're actually going to sort out our marketing plan in far more detail. And yeah, we'll see what happens. So that's happening. Desecration is on special price at 99 cents because I have some promotion planned. Basically, with Desecration, because it's the first one in a new series and there isn't a follow-up, well, there is, it's Delirium, but it's not ready yet. what's interesting is it's now I have another series, it's working out how it's different to the Arcane series. When you have just one book in any at all, I think it's very difficult. So my Arcane series is very clearly action-adventure, but it does have a supernatural edge. Now, Desecration, I pitched to BookBub at thriller, for a thriller or a mystery, and they said they have put it in supernatural suspense, which is fascinating. So I wouldn't have put it in there, but now they say it, I'm like, oh, supernatural suspense, maybe. Because one of my characters is a psychic, so it will be interesting to see how that works on BookBub. And it's doubly fascinating, I think, because branding obsesses me and I find it really interesting how we peg ourselves when we have so many different facets. And I already have two brands with The Creative Pen and JF Pen. So JF Pen is dark, but also supernatural and action adventure and thriller and crime and mystery. So, yeah. Anyway, if you're struggling with your own branding, I understand and empathise. Yeah, so spanning the genre thing is obviously something indies do well, but we still have to work at it, essentially. Okay, that's it for now, a little introduction, and we will get on with the interview. And first up, the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. Here is a short message from our sponsor.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations at Kobo. Wanted to tell you a little bit about Kobo Writing Life, which you can find at kobo.com/writinglife. It is the free do-it-yourself platform for getting your books published into Kobo's catalog. One of the reasons why you may want to log in directly to Kobo Writing Life rather than coming through a third-party aggregator is that it gives you tighter control over your books. One of the things you can use for tighter control is the ability to set your price in 8 different currencies, take advantage of pre-orders, and schedule price promotions. Lots of great opportunities available for Kobo Writing Life, and you can learn a little bit more at kobowritinglife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and today I'm here with Ryan Holiday. Hi Ryan.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Great to have you on the show. So just as a little introduction, Ryan is a media strategist for corporate brands and best-selling authors like Tim Ferriss and Tucker Max, as well as the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of Trust Me, I'm Lying. And today we're talking about his new book, The Obstacle is the Way, The Ancient Art of Turning Adversity to Advantage. And I've got my copy here. Here it is. So brilliant book, Ryan. Thank you so much for that.
That's the UK edition, it looks like, as well.
Oh right, yeah, this is the purple one. Is that a different one?
This is the US one.
Ah right. Ah, I think the UK one is. The
so
UK
it's a little different.
Very cool. I think
yeah, I like that one better actually.
Purple one is cool. Okay, so I wanted to get straight into asking you about branding, because you have this book, basically, Trust Me, I'm Lying, and then you've got this sort of very intelligent, philosophical self-help book, The Obstacle is the Way. So how are you living stoicism in your very mixed branded life?
I actually don't see them as being sort of in conflict at all. Stoicism is about sort of making the best out of less than ideal situations, right? And my first book is about a media environment that I think is very corrupt and conflicted and confusing for people. And so my approach when I was younger was one of sort of, okay, let's be very realistic about what it is. Let's be very honest about what it is. And then let's try to make the best out of it, given the job that we've been tasked with doing. So stoicism has sort of been my personal system for dealing with problems or, you know, undesirable situations. And then this book is, you know, obviously it's a little bit broader. It's not as much about marketing. It's about sort of how you live your life. And that's sort of where I would see the two working together.
And it's interesting because some people might see stoicism as a kind of, you know, dead philosophers, ancient classical situation. Maybe you could just give a sort of broad overview of why people should care about stoicism in, you know, today.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not so much why they should care. It's why they should join all the other people that are practicing it. Stoicism is huge in the armed forces. It's huge in, obviously, in academia. It's huge in the entrepreneurial community. It's always been huge with writers and creative types. It's sort of, although it's obviously quite old, it's thousands of years old, it's always existed through history. And, you know, I sort of follow them through history, everyone from, you know, George Washington to Ambrose Bierce to James Stockdale. There's been all sorts of, you know, sort of explicit practitioners of Stoicism, and then people who were living Stoicism, whether they knew it or not. Stoicism is not like a religion where you have to accept certain tenets. It's much more about how you actually exist and function in life. So there's plenty of people who I would consider to be Stoics who maybe have no idea.
And oh, it's interesting because a lot of your writing, you do a lot of strategy and war stuff, and the book is obviously full of very famous men, but you do have a woman in the book, don't you? Perhaps
there's a bunch. But it's more than one.
There is a lot of masculinity, I guess, in the examples. Perhaps you could just tell us about, I like the Amelia Earhart example.
Yeah, what I liked about Amelia Earhart is her sort of first offer for a transatlantic flight was one that I think most people would rightfully consider to be pretty insulting. It was, you're going to have chaperones, you are going to not be paid, they're going to be paid. By the way, you're not even our first choice. We already went to someone else before you who turned it down. And it's like, what did she say to that? She said, okay, that's fine, I'll make it work. And so she starts off the action section of the book, which is, you know, how do you get started? How do you start moving? I think so many people, they suffer problems, whether even if it's just in writing, they don't know how to start their project. And there is no magical way other than just doing it. It's you sit your ass in the chair and you get to work. And I liked that she was willing to do that. And she also knew that it didn't matter what the opportunity was, if someone gave her even the smallest one, she would be able to parlay that into something bigger. And I think that's something that, you know, my generation has trouble with. And I think creative types have trouble with too. Like, they want their first story to be published in the New Yorker, or they need a major publisher to tell them that they're good enough, rather than just going out there and getting an audience.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting. I really liked the book talks about having an emotional even keel and not being affected by massive highs and lows. So how do authors in particular balance, you know, this, given what you're saying, the vagaries of bestseller lists and lots of money this month and rejection and self-doubt? How do authors get that emotionally even keel?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'm going through that right now. I sold more than enough copies to hit for the first week. I sold more than enough copies to hit New York Times and more than enough to hit Wall Street Journal. And I didn't make either list, which is which I think, you know, 2 years ago would have been crushing because I hit the list with my first book. But I'm having been familiar with how those lists work, I was very much prepared for that to happen. And I knew that it does happen all the time. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't I wanted to sell as many copies as possible, but I see so many authors take their eye off the ball in terms of building an audience or building a sort of sustainable marketing machine for their book to chase these sort of arbitrary status symbols that are being a best-selling author. And so for this book, I said, I'm going to do everything I can, but I'm not trying to make the bestseller list. Like, it'll be nice if it happens, but I'm not trying for it. And then I had to test that in the real world when I sold enough copies and didn't hit it. I think, you know, it's about understanding why you want something, whether that something matters or not. And what the Stoics do is they make a distinction between things that are in our control and things that are outside our control. I control how many copies I sell. I don't control what does or doesn't make the list. And I have to make that distinction. And I can't place my expectations or my happiness on an external, or I'm setting myself up to be disappointed, possibly.
Mm, absolutely. And just in case people don't realize, because you obviously have an insight into media manipulation, and the lists are a crazy thing in general. Can you explain why you didn't hit the list then?
I mean, that's the thing, is you don't necessarily know, because it's sort of a black box, but you know certain factors influence the list. And you also have to just understand that these are not reflections of actual sales. They are a reflection of sales plus a bunch of editorial criteria that is often selectively applied. And you know, it's like a lot of life. You can put yourself in a position to succeed, but sometimes the actual markers of success are a little bit outside you. You can deserve a promotion. That doesn't mean you're going to get it. And the world is not always right, and it's not always fair. And I think if you can be prepared for that, it's not going to wreck you when it sometimes doesn't go your way.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I read, you know, your Confessions book as well, which I thought was great. And how do you stop yourself, because you do so much marketing work, how do you stop yourself getting very cynical about all of this stuff?
You know, you can't stop yourself entirely. And I don't think cynicism is necessarily unhealthy. I think sometimes it can be sort of protective and illustrative. So it's not something I necessarily try to avoid. But, you know, I understand that the process has to be enough. Like, making a book, getting it in front of readers, that's why you have to be doing it. If you are in the writing or art business to be loved by critics or to be recognized by these various institutions, you are essentially putting your happiness in somebody else's hands, and you don't know how they're going to treat it.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Now, I was really interested with the book because a lot of my listeners write fiction, and I was fascinated by the nature of conflict, overcoming obstacles. You know, what are some of the things from the book that can help authors craft fictional stories?
Sure. I mean, it was a stretch for me because although I write nonfiction, I'm usually talking about sort of my own thoughts or opinions. So it was a stretch for me to write, like, this book is mostly stories. So I had to learn myself, like, how do you sort of write and tell a story? And, you know, at first I was very overwhelmed by the prospect. It was like, I'm sitting down, it's like, oh wait, I can't believe I just sold the proposal. Now I'm going to have to tell these like 50 stories, which I have no experience doing, like I'm screwed. And then it's like, how do you get good at telling stories? By telling a lot of them. And so if there's 50 in this book, I wrote many more than that. I rewrote these many times. It's like sometimes the only way to accomplish a skill is to sort of throw yourself in the deep end and really struggle at it. I guess one of the things that I realized with the book, and this is sort of a metaphor obviously, is I talk about, you know, a lot of times we face an obstacle and our reaction is to sort of attack it head on. Hmm. When really that's sort of the worst way to you know, that gives up so many strategic benefits, whether it's surprise or what have you. So I talk about the indirect approach, and I think that's something that authors and creative types can think more about. You know, am I attacking this head on, or just sometimes going around or illustrating something by omission or obliquely? Is that not more powerful? Mm-hmm. I just read an interesting work of fiction yesterday called "I Pity the Poor Immigrant," which is about Meyer Lansky and his attempt to immigrate to Israel near the end of his life. And it's this very powerful book, but when you read it, it's like nothing happens in this book. Like basically nothing happens, but he's sort of so constantly alluding to things, and the figures that he picks have such interesting backgrounds and stories that it kind of all adds up to something being very powerful. But he didn't sit down to write like an ominous gangster novel, but he still harnesses all that power. And so I think that indirect approach can be really interesting.
Mm, absolutely. And of course, that just the general overcoming conflicts is kind of the generally in fiction, that's what you have to do, throw bad stuff at your characters so they overcome.
Right.
Yeah. And I was interested as well, because you've mentioned on other podcasts that you want this book to stand alongside The War of Art by Stephen uh-huh. Pressfield. Why do you feel that that book is so important, and how has that impacted your own creative process?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's even that book, like, is probably a good example of the indirect approach. It's about art, but he's sort of telling stories and illustrating in a way that feels much less preachy than most book. Like, most books about writing and art are really bad. They're just, like, not good at all. And, you know, Stevens is obviously different, and I think it's clearly been vindicated by the market. That book was very influential to me. I think it's a very quick, simple read that a lot of people have gotten a lot of value out of. So I wanted to write a book that is going to help a lot of people over a long period of time. I wanted to be like, I could have put myself in the book. It was actually something like the publisher wanted. I didn't want it to be at all in the first person. I didn't want it to have like a lot of current examples, because you don't know how they're going to pan. I don't want to talk about, you know, what like Google is doing right now, because it, or what YouTube is doing or something, because it might not, who knows how that's going to play out. And so I want it to be very timeless. I want it to be to sort of talk about timeless themes. And that's, you know, I hope I succeeded at that.
Mm. And it's interesting, you talk about timeless themes, and you also in the book talks about meditating on mortality, which I do a lot. I write a lot of dark fiction,
sure.
A lot of death. But you obviously work with people who have fame and money and the things that most people think that they want. What are your thoughts around what will last, and what are you aiming for in a body of work?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. It's like, okay, you try to write a book that is timeless and will last for a long time, but then you also have to remember that, like, no, Proust doesn't care that we're still reading his book, and neither does Mark Twain, because they're dead and they don't know. And so I think a lot of people, writers especially, can be very caught up with their legacy, or, you know, lasting forever, or all that. And it's very tempting and seductive, but you have to remember that, like, your work may outlive you, but you have no idea. And so you should write something that you're happy with now, that you can get out now, that doesn't wreck you or ruin your life also. So like, the timelessness is important to me, but it was also like, I cared about the timelessness because I wanted a book that would last, but I also, it was more like, I just didn't want to write a book that I wasn't proud of, that I felt didn't, you know, stand up next to the books that I really admired and I thought were good. So, you know, I talk about meditating on your own mortality. I think, you know, the darkness that you were talking about is important. A lot of people are too skittish to think about the fact that life is short, that life is brief, that things like fame or money, they don't last, and that you've got to remember that, and that realism is honest and authentic and important.
Hmm. And knowing that, and knowing the people that you do, what is your definition of success?
I think it's hard because I think we all obviously have our own definitions of it. But to me, it's being able to get up and write about something that I care about, that I feel is important, and having an audience who can receive and benefit from it. Like, I'm not interested in writing from obscurity for 40 years and then hoping that I'll be appreciated after my death or something. That's not like, maybe that works for some people, but that's not the game that I want to play.
No, fair enough. I get that. And it's interesting because you are a huge reader. And what I like about your website is you have a sign up for your email list, is your reading list, basically, which is awesome.
Sure.
What do you think about the changing way that people read? And how do you think that's going to affect? Like, you have a very nice hardback book here. It's also available on Kindle and all the ebooks. But what do you think about the way that reading is changing? And how will that affect authors and your clients, basically?
So it's weird. Like, you can see in the background, like, it's all physical books. That's all I read. And I really appreciate physical books. And I think it's important for my reading and learning process. But I'm not one of these people that's like in love with independent bookstores and loves like the smell of books. Like, I think part of the problem with publishing is people have forgotten that books are just a vehicle for ideas. And it doesn't really matter if the vehicle changes, provided that it still can deliver interesting or important ideas. So, like, my last book started as a Kindle single, and then based on sales, we decided to turn it into a paperback. So I definitely am fine experimenting. I read a lot online. I think that if there's one sort of technology that I would push back on, it's this new thing. Have you seen it where it's like, it's supposed to be so you can speed read really quickly? Like, it just flashes like one word in front of your face. Not only is that sort of missing the point of reading, it's not supposed to be a race, but the struggle of reading and the time that it takes our mind to understand and comprehend words is part of the cognition process from the research that I've read, and part of what helps us remember and make connections on what we read. So I think if the technology is about making reading more accessible and cheaper and empowering new authors to reach audiences, I think it's fantastic and I don't have any problem with it. When it's about stripping some of the benefits intrinsic in the written word, that's where I start to have some problems with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And of course, part of your reading is research for the books. And I know you have this incredible research process. Right. Could you talk a bit about that?
It's funny, like, people go like, oh, like, how do you read so much? And it's like, well, it's my job. So I'm not expecting you to read as much as I do. Like, I'm reading for work and like block out time in my day to read. So it's a little bit different, but I learned this from Robert Greene, who was my mentor. I read a book. I usually have a pen or I fold pages and I mark the things that I think were important. And then a couple weeks later, I sort of go back through the book. I take notes. I transfer those to note cards. So here's a bunch of them with writing on them. So I transfer them to note cards. And then those note cards are organized by theme in boxes. And each book is normally its own box. And that's sort of that's my personal system. Right now I am probably 40 books behind in terms of transferring them to note cards because I've been so busy. But that's the system that I try to observe.
Mm. And then how do you synthesize those? Like, many of us use Scrivener. Do you use Scrivener, or how do you synthesize that into a book?
No, just the note cards, and then the note cards are in themes. And so, like, let's say the obstacle is the ways, it's three parts, and then an intro and a conclusion. So there were five sections, and then note cards go in each sort of little section. And then each, like, part one, two, and three are, let's say, 15 individual chapters. Mm-hmm. Then they're broken up into 15 smaller subsections. So each section is a stack of note cards with a little like a file folder. And then I, like, let's say I have to write part two, chapter six, I just take, and I'm traveling, I just take those cards with me and I write until I'm done and then they go back in the box.
Wow, that's so analog.
Yeah, and then I actually, up above my desk, I have a box of articles and papers that I'm reading that are like materials for the book that are not note cards. So it's like, if there's a really good New York Times piece that I read, I'll take notes, and then it goes in the box until I transfer it to note cards later.
Wow, that's amazing. And I also heard you say on one interview that people shouldn't write nonfiction books if they haven't sorted out what they're going to say first.
Well, I try to crack the code of the book first. So I find it to be very dangerous, and maybe it's a little different with fiction, I don't know. But where people just like sit down and they're like, chapter one, and they just take it wherever it leads them. In nonfiction, that leads to a very meandering, pointless, unclear thesis. I think, you know, nonfiction is normally, if you should be able to distill every nonfiction book down to like a single sentence, and then every sentence should be a meditation or a callback to that theme over and over again. And you should know where the examples fit. And so I'm a big proponent of structure and organization. And I just see so many authors just kill themselves by writing all this material that they ultimately end up cutting because it has no part of what they're trying to say. Like, I'm a big fan of Robert Caro, who wrote like The Power Broker. He wrote a bunch of biographies of Lyndon Johnson. I heard like one of his books was like, they had to cut like 250,000 words from one of his books. And to me, that just seems like, obviously he's a pro, so I'm not criticizing him at all, but that just seems like the saddest thing in the entire world to me. Can you imagine cutting that many words?
There are lots of fiction authors who are listening who have had to cut that many words.
I can't even wrap my head around it.
No, I know what you mean. I'm a sparse writer myself. Now I'm interested just to switch into marketing. You say in the book,
yeah,
Action is commonplace, right action is not. And I think that applies,
sure,
to book marketing as much as anything,
yeah,
else. So I wonder, what do you see as, right now, as, you know, obviously you're going through it, the best things to do a nonfiction book launch?
Well, obviously I think podcasts are big. I probably spent the single most amount of time doing podcasts for this. I think content marketing is very big. A lot of people, they write the book and then, you know, publishers are very concerned about excerpts. I think you should give away as much of the book as you conceivably can. No one ever goes like, oh, I was going to buy that book, but I read too many great articles from it. Now I'm not going to. You know what I mean? It's much more like, why should I spend $30 on this? I don't know if it's any good or not. So I think, you know, giving away as much as possible in interesting, compelling ways. I think if you're not building a list or an audience, you are putting yourself at the mercy of Amazon or book publishers or someone else to sell your book, and they never do a good job. So I, to go to your question, I think it's like a lot of people work very hard marketing their books and don't sell a lot of copies because they haven't planned it out and they haven't really questioned like what the ROI on each action is.
And I mean, obviously I think it's brilliant you're doing podcasts because you're online, but why do you think podcasts have become so popular and why focus on it so much?
Well, it's I think podcasts have really exploded because of smartphones. It's so easy to download them and to listen to them. I think that's why audiobooks are doing really well right now. But you've got to realize that the vehicles to find out about new books have basically disappeared. Like, newspapers don't publish book reviews. Radio doesn't have time for a lot of authors. There's not that many smart mediums left. Like, people who listen to podcasts buy books because most people don't listen to podcasts. You know what I mean? It's like, what are smart people doing? They're listening to podcasts, they're reading blogs, and they're reading books. So you can, that's where you can find, you know, potential people for your audience.
Yeah, fantastic. And do you think that people are craving the author's voice in some way? Like people, like I wanted to hear your physical voice as well as just the written word. Do you think people do want that?
Yeah, you know what? I think that's part of it. I think now we expect more than just a good book. We want to know about how it was created and who made it and what they were thinking. And so I think that's definitely part of it. Like, I've seen the audio, like I've done two of my three audiobooks, and I've definitely seen a much greater response when I did the audiobook myself than when I did. So, you know, I think it's, I think, you know, Austin, I don't know if you know who Austin Kleon is, but he wrote Steal Like an Artist. He taught, it's like, show your work, like show the strings, like show what's behind the process, and don't, you don't need to do it all in private, sort of hidden in the writer's den or something. Like, expose part of yourself, and it makes your work more accessible.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's very cool. And then in terms of, you know, I guess things on marketing that are really bad, what are the biggest time wasters, you think, for book marketing?
You know what? I'm not going to say there's any huge time wasters, because most of those things have sort of gone away. I think the biggest mistake that I see authors make, and this is what I deal with my clients most often, is they make decisions that they think are creative decisions that are actually have marketing implications. And they pick a bad title, they pick a bad cover,
yeah.
They write about something that there isn't a big audience for. And then they expect marketing can dig them out of those holes, and it can't.
Mm. Okay, so really being strategic.
It's like the best marketing decision you can make is, the best marketing decision you can make is to write a really good book. And then to write a really good book for an audience that you know is hungry for a book about this thing. And it's not like, hey, go wait for inspiration to randomly strike. You know, write this book and then 2 years later put it on Amazon and hope that it's magically going to be successful because you were on NPR. That's like not a great model for success.
Mm. And do you think that your blogging has played a big part? Because you write a lot on blogs, Thought Catalog and other places. Do you think that that has been, that continues to be part of that, why people want to hear from you?
Sure. I mean, look, I've built up a huge list. Like my list is, I don't know, 20,000 people now, from my reading recommendations. You know, I've built up media contacts at places that will publish stuff that I've written. I acquire every day, even for articles that I wrote 2 or 3 years ago, I get someone new will read them and become a fan of my work. And that sort of sucks them into my universe. And that's something that I've thought about a lot. It's like, you know, I wrote an article about why you should drop out of college. And that brings in young kids who like what I have to say and then read one of my books. And I think a lot of authors, they go like, oh, I'm just a book writer. So I can't do any of that stuff. But to me, it matters and it works.
Mm. And just one more question on the writing nonfiction. Do you think that getting the right point, getting it organized is why you should do a proposal or a pitch, even if you're self-publishing?
Sure. What I tell people when they're thinking about it is I say you might as well try a proposal, because who knows, you might sell it for a lot of money, which would be nice. And two, it's never going to hurt that you organized and synthesized your idea down into a very clear and compelling explanation and outline.
Sorry, carry on.
I hate proposals. I think they're really, really hard. It's really hard for me. Like, I'm working on my fourth proposal right now. It's really hard just to write a proposal for something that you haven't. I don't know what the book is going to be. Like, that's the whole point. Like, that's what I got to go spend like 2 years thinking about, you know? But I do think it's really important, and you can tell when someone hasn't done it.
Yeah. And then just on publishing, I mean, you know, a lot of different authors who are publishing in different ways. What do you see as the way publishing is going? And, you know, what are your kind of predictions for that in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think it's becoming increasingly hard for people who don't have an audience or don't have an idea that has an audience. Like I was saying, I think audiobooks are sort of seeing a resurgence, so I think that's interesting. I think you're seeing books be a little shorter, a little more straightforward. The idea of like taking 7 years to go write a book or something, I think is very hard to do. Not to say that's necessarily a positive trend. I'm just saying, like, I think you're seeing smaller, more concise books with more of a clear purpose and call to action. So I think those are some trends. Obviously, there's a lot more. I think you're seeing that even authors who publish with traditional publishers are having to become more entrepreneurial and take on more of the project. Like, you're the CEO. The publisher is just your investor.
Hmm.
You know, I think that's a way to think about it.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then just as a roundup, just talk a bit more about The Obstacle is the Way, and who is going to find this useful amongst the audience listening?
Yeah. So the book is based on Stoicism. It's this idea that, look, we don't control the world around us. We control how we respond to it. So it's the meditation on this single line from Marcus Aurelius where he says, the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. And then I unpack that idea through stories. Amelia Earhart, John D. Rockefeller, Ulysses S. Grant, Eisenhower, Margaret Thatcher, Churchill. I sort of just, Abraham Lincoln, I tell these stories that illustrate the ideas and the approach required towards tackling really difficult situations and scenarios, and not just surviving them, but ideally like sort of thriving because of them. That's the idea. It's a book I've wanted to write for a really, really long time, and now it's here. It's gotten a great response, so I'm really excited about it.
Fantastic. And where can people find you and the book online?
Sure. The book's available, obviously, Amazon, bookstores everywhere. My website is ryanholiday.net. That's where you can sign up for the reading newsletter. And then I'm just Ryan Holiday on Twitter.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Ryan. That was great.
Thanks for having me. This was awesome.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.